Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR news, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so, we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Our show is called Main Street because our microphones create a Main Street all across our state this time of day. Those real Main Streets are the centers of our communities where we meet and greet each other, talk about what's on our minds, you know, maybe hunker down, head to the cafe when it gets cold, but it's where we chat with each other. And today we're going to chat about an author who really put our part of the world on the map. 2017 was the 150th anniversary of Laura Ingalls Wilder's birthday. Her classic coming-of-age stories told through the beloved Little House books amounted to an iconic statement of American identity. Early last month, we interviewed Caroline Fraser about her new book, Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder, which filled gaps in Wilder's life story by drawing on unpublished manuscripts, letters, diaries, and financial records. Well, today, we'll hear about a new book from author Marta McDowell, The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Frontier Landscapes That Inspired the Little House Books, which takes a close look at the places that Wilder called home. McDowell was recently interviewed for South Dakota Public Broadcasting's In the Moment by host Lori Walsh.
Marta McDowell, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
First off, this is just a gorgeous book. The book design is lovely. The pages are glossy and filled with Garth Williams color illustrations, paintings by Harvey Dunn, historic photographs, maps, and these lovely illustrations of the prairie flora that we can see. Tell me a little bit about, you've written other books, Beatrix Potter's Gardening Life, Emily Dickinson's Gardens. How does this fit into what you're trying to do as a whole as an author? Why Laura?
Well, I'm very interested in authors who garden or who have a strong connection to the land. And what better person to write about than Laura Ingalls Wilder? Because she really resonates across the country as sort of a quintessential American writer. We think of her as a children's writer, but now that I've come back to her as an adult, I think we can also look at her as a nature writer.
How so? What are sort of the hallmarks of being classified as a nature writer that you think qualifies her for that distinction?
So she lived in many different places and wrote about them. And she wrote about one place that she had never lived, her husband's home in upstate New York. But every place that she writes about very specific plants and animals. She writes about the weather. She writes about the lay of the land and the water sources. You know, today we would call it ecology, right? She's writing about the ecology of the place. And then she was just really talking about the description of these places that she loved and that meant so much to her as she grew older, because she wrote about these places, from memory. She was late 50s, in her 60s when she was writing these books. And so they were very rich for her, and she left that, sort of documentation behind for us.
Right. The land becomes, wherever she travels, really part a character in and of itself. She creates a characterization of the landscape wherever she lives, doesn't she?
And I think especially in South Dakota, or in the Dakota Territory as she knew it, because half of the series is about Dakota, right? Mm-hmm. So, if she wrote 8 books in the original series, 4 of them are about DeSmit. And so she has a lot of time to develop that setting. And it really does have its own character and flexes its muscles a lot, particularly in the hard winter.
Right. That point in their family life when they become stayers, when they decide not to keep going west but to stay right where they're at, does that then influence how she, you know, how she can and how she is able to talk about the natural world around her in greater detail because she's there longer and sees it change more frequently?
I think so, because, you know, instead of seeing, you know, one season in Kansas or Indian Territory, and, you know, sort of long, long ago, a couple of years in Wisconsin, she really does live there for a chunk of her life. And she grows up there. So, you know, that's where she is an adolescent, a teenager, an adult. And, you know, the first years of her married life are there as well. And she sees it good times and bad and talks about both of those things. I mean, you know, I don't think I would have made it through what they did.
And you have these moments where you write, you know, either your own memories or your own experiences. And there is a section where you say that you're standing out in the snow and your boots aren't tight enough. And you're like, I don't think I could have done this.
And, you know, and I have on these, you know, right? high-tech insulate lined boots and all my gear. And, you know, I'm whining because I'm standing out there for, you know, a half hour
right?
doing some research.
Tell me a little bit about your journey, though, as you sort of retrace some of these steps.
It was such a wonderful, you know, kind of trail ride for me, right? So Here I am. I've grown up on the East Coast. I mean, we used to spend summers out in the middle of Illinois. But, you know, I was really a suburban kid. So I decided, well, I couldn't possibly write this book if I hadn't seen all of the places. And so the first trip I took to DeSmit was in February, which I think was very appropriate. I got stuck in O'Hare Airport because there was a blizzard. And I learned a little bit about driving on your highways in the middle of the winter. But that was good because that's all part of it, right? And you can see the land in a different way, right? I always love to look at the landscapes in winter because you really see the bones of the land. You see where the streams and rivers are and how it rolls, and you don't have the distraction of all of the other stuff in the summer. And, you know, I got to go visit the big old cottonwoods on the Ingalls homestead. And
tell us about those trees. Tell us why Laura's father, Charles, why those trees were so important. It's a great story from the book.
Well, you know, the cottonwoods were the first tree that, according to the books, he planted around their claim shanty. And I think it was, you know, kind of symbolic in the book as well as, you know, this is the place that we're going to actually set down roots. Yeah. I mean, even though her father did kind of think about moving on, it was the place that they stuck. And they saw that town grow from just the railroad line and the surveyor's cottage, right, where they wintered that first winter, to being an actual town and having a whole life. You know, she talks about, you know, going to singing school and the spelling bees and the sociables and, you know, the picnics, and you read the old DeSmit papers, and, you know, they had a roller skating rink. I mean, it was a very, very vibrant community that they formed there.
So the first time you saw the prairie, you write in the book, you really saw it through a car window as you were traveling with your parents, and delightful descriptions of what it's like to be a kid traveling across country, which I don't think people do in quite the same way, where you're laying down on top of each other with no seatbelts and stretching out.
No seatbelts and no air conditioning.
That's right. And one of your siblings wants the window down and the other wants it up. And you say at that point, it's a little boring outside, is your first impression as a youngster. What do you say to people now who think the prairie is still a boring landscape?
Well, I just think that you need to look a little harder. And, you know, my mother grew up in the middle of Illinois, and she always said, oh, I think it's beautiful. And I really understand it now, particularly this skies. I will tell you that the skies are so moving. You know, the changes in the skies and the cloud patterns. Again, you know, being from the East Coast, first of all, our skies are closed in because we do have a lot of trees and little hills, and we just don't get the set same kind of really strong continental weather pattern. And in Wilder's book, she talks so much about the weather and the birds and the sunsets and the, you know, the effect of the rains and the snow, the different kinds of feelings in the snow, and so much about prairie wildflowers. I was stunned at how many identifiable plants there were through Wilder's work. That was one of the, you know, sort of nerdy things that I did in the process of writing this, was just compile all of these plants so that if people wanted to have their own little bit of Laura Ingalls Wilder in their garden, they could do that.
And that's just one of the best parts, is to look at each one of those delicate and interesting and surprising wildflower offerings. I'm wondering, you know, you've written about Beatrix Potter, who I'm a big fan of, and you've written about Emily Dickinson, and I wonder if you see connections between these women writers and how they sort of interacted with the land and how they behaved as writers. Do you see parallels at all?
They were all inspired in slightly different ways by the world around them, the natural world around them. And so they all wrote about plants. They wrote about some of the same plants, which is very interesting. Things like the violet and the rose go through all of these women's writing. And I don't know if that was the time period. You know, they're all, you know, at least start out in the 19th century. Wilder lives till 1957, so up to the into the modern era. You know, but I think that they really were attuned to it. They all were connected to food growing in one way or another. You know, the Ingalls family and the Wilder families were dependent on farming for their living, which wasn't true of the others. But they all, you know, kind of had a hand in. And so it's been fun to see some of those things and how they click together.
There are some indications that Laura Ingalls Wilder really liked maybe flowers sometimes a little more than she liked people. So she has an affection for some of the plants that she finds, and she sort of grouches about some of the people who are moving into the places where she lives. Do you characterize her as an introvert? Does she have the heart of her father there? And her mother, what did you learn about her as you look at the way she interacts with plants?
You know, I think she was a little conflicted because as much as she loved the wild prairie, she also did love to you know, socialize and go out with people. Right up through her whole life, she always had these kind of women's groups and things that she was involved in. But she always loved nature. She wrote a lot of farm journalism before she started writing her autobiography, which, you know, came out from the South Dakota Historical Society Press as Pioneer Girl, and then the novels. But she wrote about wildflowers and Almanzo bringing her wildflowers and what that meant to her. She wasn't much of a flower gardener, although her daughter was, but she loved flowers. And she loved gathering them and sort of having them around her.
Did you read these books as a child? I know you write about putting food up with your mother and sort of canning and preserving. Did you grow up with these books?
I did read some of them. I was not a good series reader. That was not just true of Wilder. I read voraciously but sort of randomly. So I read a few of them. And then started over again, you know, as an adult and read through them in order several times. So that was a treat.
And your process of writing this book, did you feel more connected to her? Were there surprises waiting for you in the research?
The biggest surprises to me were things like, well, she and Almanzo had lived in Florida for a year, which I found really surprising. And then the fact that she lived the majority of her life in Missouri, which I didn't know until I started on the research for this book, that she spent so much of her life in the Ozarks. But yet, now that I'm about her age, when she was writing them down, I understand how your childhood memories can get even more vivid. You know, I can picture things that happened to me in my childhood that are really kind of technicolor moments. And I think maybe that heightens with age. I'm not sure.
And reading it with your background, your botany and horticulture background must be a different read through the books as well than what you might have experienced as a child.
Yes, and I think however you are as an adult, if you go back and read these, you put your own lenses on them, right? So, you know, I'm interested in the natural world, in plants in particular, but in things like, you know, I was reading about her descriptions of courting with Almanzo and very, very red sunsets. Mm. And it just popped into my head, this word, Krakatoa. And I thought, could this possibly have been at the same time? And it absolutely was. So I was so delighted to find that out, because the eruption of Krakatoa in 1883 started this couple of year cycle of these extremely red sunsets around the globe. And she writes about them, and they're written about in the DeSmit papers as well, and in the South Dakota newspapers of the time. And they weren't sure what was causing it, but they, you know, you always have delightful sunsets, but they were particularly red during that period.
Hmm. Marty McDowell, the book is called The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Frontier Landscapes That Inspired the Little House Books. Thank you for your inspiration today.
Author Marta McDowell speaking with South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Laurie Walsh. McDowell is working on a revision of her first book, Emily Dickinson's Gardens, which is due in 2019. She teaches landscape history and horticulture at the New York Botanical Garden and consults for private clients in public gardens. Coming up on Main Street, Tom Ezern.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Christopher O'Reilly, host of From the Top from NPR. It all goes back to being 4 years old and going to St. Athanasius Catholic School in Evanston, Illinois. They said that you could have French lessons or piano lessons at $15 a week. Take your pick. And that's basically how I got to where I am today. I would have been terrified to tell my piano teacher when I was a kid that I was learning, you know, the organ solo to The Doors Light My Fire. From the Top has been engaging in the YouTube platform, mixing genres, lots of interaction with, you know, great people from classical and crossover world, kids collaborating with Time for Three, Joshua Bell. It was a really great one with Pink Martini. I really enjoyed that. I did one with kids on From the Top, and it was about the time of the Muslim ban and Lady Gaga's performance of Woody Guthrie at the Super Bowl. So I had six immigrant alums of From the Top, and we collected all of their various national anthems and made snippets of it into a piece that introduced This Land Is Your Land. And we did that at the YouTube studios itself. Join me every Sunday at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain, From the Top on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern teaches and writes about history. He's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and he writes about his research in scholarly texts and in a series of plainsfolk essays. Today, he gives voice to an essay titled Beaches of Manitoba.
The ancient beaches of Lake Agassiz are subtle features in the landscape, generally unnoticed except by persons specifically looking for them. I recognize some of the beaches when I cross them, but am too geologically ignorant to discern most of them. I do claim to know something about books, however, so I am embarrassed to confess how undiscerning I was on first reading Bill Redekop's new book, Lake Agassiz, The Rise and Demise of the World's Greatest Lake. I'll resume my confession in a minute, but first, to explain what I'm talking about, Bill Redekop is a fine journalist in Winnipeg, who takes particular delight in exploring the prairie landscape and drawing our attention to its wonders. He has published this book on Lake Agassiz with Heartland, a publishing house in the Peg. The work is, of course, of considerable interest here in the southern reaches of the valley, and its implications stretch far across the state of North Dakota, but it's sort of an outlaw book here because it comes from a Canadian publisher. It's such a wonderful book that you may want to make inquiries with your favorite wink, wink independent bookstore and see if it might have a speakeasy copy for you. Bill's subject, Lake Agassiz, is a geological basis for the Red River Valley. It was a glacial lake formed when the frozen masses of the Ice Age began to retreat and melt, producing unfathomable quantities of meltwater, but remained in the north to block the water's outlet to Hudson Bay. Thus, this great inland lake, the largest known to history, which existed in its various permutations from about 13,000 years before present to about 8,500 years before present. Now, my embarrassment is this. I was captivated by Chapter 14, entitled Campbell Beach, Far Away in Time, in which Bill traverses the ancient shoreline through Arden, the crocus capital of Manitoba, and other serene prairie towns, and through sublimely pastoral landscapes. I thought, this is Bill being Bill, unfolding the terrain for our wonderment. My wife, who was driving at the time, noticed my appreciative mutterings and, glancing across, pointed out to me that Chapter 14 had a blue graphic spanning the page folds that is not used for the rest of the book. Then she asked, does the chapter have color photographs? Do the other chapters have color photographs? Answer, yes, and then no. As a publisher and editor, she delighted to observe how Bill and his publisher and his designer had taken me in. They knew this chapter was the most compelling one in the book, and they maximized its impact on me without me realizing why. For which I'm not resentful, but grateful. Bill, you see, does pretty well as a historian. He informs us about Louis Agassiz, for whom the lake is named, and about Warren Upham, who explored and named it. We can learn a lot from the whole book, but it truly comes to life when Bill is in and on the landscape, himself delighting in it. I tried blending a study of geology with local knowledge, Bill writes. I found following beach ridges proved to be a unique brand of tourism. It's scenic in a way that we're not used to thinking about scenery. Exploration and imagination in the admixture proposed by Bill Redekop, this is how we may bring the landscape alive for sleepy travelers of the Red River Valley.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, we'll revisit one of our interviews from 2017 when our Ashley Thornburg talks with the author of Natural North Dakota Essays, Chuck Lura. And we'll share a commentary from Jamestown's Bruce Berg. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Senator John Hoeven is in North Dakota touting the tax cut bill Congress passed and President Trump signed just before Christmas. Hoeven says it's important to remember that the bill is called the Tax Relief and Jobs Act.
It's about making sure that taxpayers keep more of their hard-earned dollars after taxes, but it's also about job creation. And as you create jobs and you grow the economy, that creates demand for labor, and that demand for labor is what moves wages and income higher. That's the other part that's very important to understand. It's not just, you know, saving some dollars with lower taxes. It's about higher wages, and that's the key.
Hoeven held a discussion at one of Bismarck's two Ace Hardware stores. The owner of the two stores, Jeff Hintz, says the bill would help businesses like his, which is a subchapter S corporation.
There's always deals for big companies. There's always deals for individuals. This is the first one that kind of paid attention to people like us. We hire people. We build. It's obvious with this store, we plow everything back in. We build, we grow, we hire, but without some assets out of what we've made, we can't do that. So for a guy like me, a tax plan like this that addresses the way small business works is really an important thing, and it's good for everybody that is employed.
Hintz says small businesses like his normally walk a tightrope between what they owe and what they owe the banks and what they owe the government, leaving very little profit margin. A Hazen area farmer says there are provisions in the new tax cut bill that will help with the agriculture industry. John Wynand says the expansion of the Section 179 deductions, which deals with the expensing of farm equipment, will help most farmers.
That's really going to help farmers in this state plan for their taxes, make sure that we keep growing our businesses. Having that deduction is a big deal. We have a capital-intensive business, and it takes a lot of money to buy the equipment that it takes to operate a farm.
The measure also doubles the estate tax exemption.
For me personally, probably not such a big deal at this point in time, but I suppose when I die, my kids will be happy to see that we're not having to give it all away to Uncle Sam.
The measure maintains interest deductibility and the property tax deduction for farmers and ranchers. And there are a little more things are a little more expensive in East Grand Forks. Starting this week, the city's new 1% local sales tax officially kicks in. Over 70% of East Grand Forks voters in 2016 supported the tax hike to pay for upgrades to the public pool. Council President Mark Alstead says the local tax will lessen the burden on property owners. The tax is expected to generate around $660,000 per year. It's slated to come off the books in less than 5 years, or when a maximum $2.8 million has been raised. Cracked pipes prevented the pool from opening this past summer. Alstead says the goal is to complete the repairs before the upcoming swim season and recover the costs from responsible parties. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
The 21st Annual Celebration of Women and Their Music will be held Saturday, January 20th at the stage at Island Park, featuring Brenda Wyler, Rosie Savageau-Nestingen, Laura Jossend, Emily Holt, Haley E. Rydell, and many more. Tickets available at 21stcelebrationofwomen.eventbrite.com. For complete information on all 3 days of events, go to debjenkins.com/celebrationofwomen.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau, in a part of the state that's off the beaten path but rich with substance for his natural North Dakota essays. Last year, Chuck talked with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg about his work and his writing.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I normally get to introduce you in the sense of, and in this week's Natural North Dakota essay, Chuck Lura. So it's fun to actually sit down, and this might be only, I think, the second time I've ever seen you face-to-face.
Yeah, so it's good to get together from that standpoint as well.
Chuck, you write the Natural North Dakota essay. You teach biology at Dakota College at Bottineau. You also write a column for the Lake Metagoshimir, the naturalist at large. Clearly, you have an interest in the outdoor world. This started at a very young age. Describe your childhood.
Yeah, I can't remember not being interested in nature. It seems like it was robins in the backyard or tulips coming up in the spring or waterfall on area ponds, but there's always been, and there still is, you know, plenty of things to look at outdoors. So I think just the fact that I grew up in a time frame I did when, Davy Crockett was kind of popular, so you could go out in the woods or go out in the grasslands and explore a little bit and pay a little bit of history in the background, but just enjoy all the nature that's around us. So, yeah, that's kind of my upbringing.
Sure, the time period in American history where mom and dad said, you know, go outside, and then when you hear the dinner bell,
that's exactly right. For us, it was the whistle. When the whistle blows, come home, but I don't want to see you until then.
So what were you doing in that childhood time?
Pretty much just, I think, what a lot of children do. We had some parks or a couple parks in my hometown where I could go and explore a little bit in the wild. And then there was a dredge ditch, nothing glamorous about a dredge ditch, but a dredge ditch on the edge of town. So a few of us would go down there, and we would see muskrats and, you know, occasional birds and great blue herons and things of that nature. So I would assume that early curiosity was piqued by those experiences.
Okay, sure. When do you think that it sort of became something more, something you wanted to dive into in your studies in college and then go on to teach?
I don't know that I ever really considered anything else. I think I'm one of the fortunate ones that had an interest early on, mm-hmm. and held on to it, and it kind of guided me that way. When I was in high school, there was no question I was going to be in the realm of biology in some capacity. And then I just pursued my education in terms of maybe a wildlife management major with perhaps a teaching option. And a little bit of experience in college told me pretty quickly that it was the teaching, for some reason I'm not quite sure, got my interest.
Okay, not quite sure, but can you put a couple words to it? What is it that you really like about teaching?
I think I like the light bulb going off when you can chip away at some concept and the students finally get it. I think there's a real joy there, mm-hmm. a satisfaction of doing something for society and the students.
Yeah.
So that I find that enjoyable.
Do you get a lot of light bulb moments? Is it the kind of thing that happens once a semester or once a week?
It's variable.
Yeah.
And sometimes the intensity is brighter than others. So you get some variation there. But you can kind of see those aha moments.
Yeah.
Whether they're, really bright light or just kind of a dim light, but it's an aha moment.
Yeah. And those dim lights can certainly grow.
Yeah.
Especially if they've got a good teacher.
Yeah.
And you've been doing this since 1984, at least, teaching at Dakota College at Botano. You taught high school before that, that's right?
I taught high school for 3 years, a couple years in South Dakota, 1 year in Iowa. And then I just kind of lost interest. I could see myself in 10 years not being quite so content with my job. So I took a little hiatus and decided I'd try a plan B, which is a bowling alley. And after about a year of that, then I was seeing that bowling alleys weren't where I wanted my future to
really,
lie.
Really? As a biologist, you didn't want to work in a bowling alley.
So then it's one of those little moments in life that turns your life in a whole direction. One of the elementary teachers approached me. She'd found out I was a high school biology teacher, asked me if I'd want to help a little bit with an outing, a sixth grade outing. They would spend a day at an area lake in my home area called Clear Lake and do various activities. And she said, you can do whatever you want. You've got, a half hour with I don't remember how many groups. So I just put together a little exercise where we took aluminum pie tins, went out to the lake, and just scooped it into the bottom, to the sandy bottom or mud bottom, and then watch all the little invertebrates and worms and stuff come out of there. And to see the sixth graders get that excited about all of that stuff.
Yeah, that's a great age for bugs.
Yeah, about a month later, I was in graduate school.
Okay.
So it was really a turning point, I think, that way to kind of help me find where I needed to go again.
Yeah, that happens. the difference maybe between teaching high school and teaching college students that when you left high school feeling kind of burnt out on that but then wanted to work in college, is it something about the students or something about the structure of a high school versus a college setting? Or why do you think you like teaching college?
I think it's the structure of the college, the little more mature students generally in college, and the fact that you're just more academically oriented. You have the time to pursue, let's say, scholarly activities, whether it's peer-reviewed research or other activities or doing a radio program on the natural world around you. You have those opportunities, I think, more so in a college university setting than in a high school.
And you teach on a small campus, Dakota College at Botano. Your class size is anywhere from one to two dozen students, so definitely small classroom
yep.
settings. Have you ever wanted to teach in sort of the big, 500-600 student lecture halls?
Yes, in a way, but in those settings, I think research is more of a priority than where my interests lie.
I keep
coming back to the education part of things, and so I'm kind of where I probably should be.
What do you like about working in a small space then, small college?
Flexibility. And with my location in the Turtle Mountains, nature is kind of right outside our doorstep. And we're a rural area, so we can have access. It's pretty good to the Turtle Mountain forests, and we've got some wildlife refuges nearby. So it kind of helps to have access to nature that way as well.
I'm sure there's no such thing as a typical day. Day in and day out, but can you kind of walk us through maybe what a semester is like in the life of Chuck Lura, biology professor, Dakota College at Botano?
Well, I'm kind of constantly preparing the lectures, whether it's update, PowerPoint presentation. It seems like, and I'm sure in all our work, we're generally trying to improve our techniques in a variety of ways. So the improvement is kind of ongoing. And then, of course, with lectures, getting taken care of those things, and then lab preparation and actually doing the labs and getting those taken care of. So it's a little bit of, I guess, a mixed bag in terms of preparedness.
We're visiting with Chuck Lura. He writes the Natural North Dakota essay that you hear more or less once a week on Prairie Public. He also writes a column for the Lake Metegoshi Mirror called Naturalist at Large, and he teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau. And this guest idea came to us from a listener. You can always send your ideas to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Chuck, of all the different branches of science, why biology? Why do you think that one really resonates with you?
I don't know. I think we all have those interests that, you know, it's hard to explain. It's just something you, I don't know if it's genetics or what, but like I mentioned earlier, nature just has been a part of my life. I don't know if that would have happened had I grown up in a different environment and a different time frame. But at least for my life experiences, it's kind of always been something of interest.
When you say genetics, what does that mean? Were your parents, you know, sort of omnicurious folks as well?
No. One parent worked in it. My dad worked in a grain elevator, and my mother was a school cook.
Okay.
I would force them to take me to trips to a nearby slough called Myrie Slough. It has some family ties. But to drive around and let me look out the window at ducks and those types of things when I was little. So I think I probably forced nature on them more than they helped me appreciate nature as a child.
So you were a teacher from the very beginning. What is it specifically when you use the term wildlife biology? What is that and how is it separate from the other branches?
My impression of wildlife biology would be pretty much the wildlife, both game and non-game species, mammals, pretty much mammals and birds, and oftentimes with a hunting and fishing aspect.
Okay.
For example, a wildlife major in colleges and universities now would be studying, for the most part, game species and some non-game species as well.
Okay.
But oftentimes involves the biology, ecology of game.
Do you get into a lot of discussions either with contemporaries or with students when it comes down to game species? You know, there is a huge debate in this world about conservationists and people who hunt and the amount of people who think that there's no overlap between those two people, those two groups. Do you get into, I don't know if that would be called the ethics of game management?
I don't get into a lot of those discussions, but yeah, okay. They're out there. And it's kind of the old adage, how is it, if hunting has to be explained to someone, they'll never probably understand it anyhow. I don't know that that's accurate, but I hear that occasionally, that there's something different about the way we perceive the world around us in terms of hunting than the ethics of it.
Well, let's talk about the essay that you write for us on Main Street, and then it also airs outside of Main Street. It's called Natural North Dakota, typically 2 to 3 minutes long. How do you choose your topics every week?
It's variable. If there's something that's timely, for example, if the Pasque flowers are blooming and I notice that's occurring, that might be a timely topic. There are other topics that aren't so timely that I can kind of pick up if I haven't observed something in the immediate vicinity. So something like the geology of an area isn't so time sensitive, whereas, you know, flowers, wildflowers and some birds or something might be more time sensitive. So it's just basically what I observe in the course of what the week prior, I suppose, as to what topic I have to choose for the Natural North Dakota.
You're not necessarily plotting this out 3, 6, 12 months down the road.
No, and I can't do that. I've tried to plot it out. You know, if I have some extra time, I've tried to kind of do 3, 4. It just doesn't work for
right.
me.
Something about the natural world that kind of says, hey, wait a second. Yeah. I'm in charge
here. And or a deadline.
Oh, there's that. How did you get started, though, this partnership that you have with Prairie Public?
It goes back to 2005. I had contemplated maybe writing a small column for a newspaper. Just a small outdoor kind of column. Then Jason Nordmark of Nordmark Publishing started the Lake Metegoshi Mirror, and it was advertised as the newest newspaper in the state back in 2005. And so I saw that, showed up in our mailbox, and I thought, I'm going to send him a letter and inquire as to if he'd like to have an outdoor column, which I did. And he said, sure, let's give it a shot and see what happens. So that started in 2005 and continues now. And through some of his other weekly newspapers, it runs in some of those other weeklies as well. And I've had fun with that. And then in, I think it was the fall of 2008, Paul Nyron, I've worked at the Central Grassland Research Extension Center for a lot of years with Paul and his wife, Ann. And he was on the, and still is on the board of Prairie Public at that time. And knowing that I was writing newspaper columns, he said, have you ever considered maybe doing something like that for radio? And I didn't know quite how to respond. No, I guess that the answer in a word would be no. But one thing led to another, and we talked to Bill Thomas here, and one thing led in. And I think I think we started in October of 2008 doing the Natural North Dakota. So that's been a fun experience as well.
Yeah. Is there a difference for you in taking the information that you learn and presenting it to a classroom full of students or writing it for a newspaper or preparing it for a radio audience?
I find for the radio audience a couple of things. I'm trying to pick a topic where it hopefully will pique some interest in that topic, and I do that in the classroom as well, but pique some interest and then maybe try to find a few facts that will kind of build on that so the audience gets a little sense of, okay, maybe I haven't looked at this before or noticed, you know, some particular item. So get a little bit of an appreciation and then let them take it from there sort of thing, where in the classroom you're more factually oriented, I think, and concepts and those types of things. And then accuracy.
Oh, yeah. We appreciate that.
I double check and triple check in some cases to make sure things are accurate.
Do people ever reach out and say, no, that isn't accurate?
Couple comments as to some nuances of accuracy. One of the articles, it was a newspaper article, dealt with the density of hair in winter coats versus summer coats of deer. So there was a little discussion there. And so I had to go back and check my sources. And, they were accurate. But, yeah, occasionally I'll get those. But more of what I get for responses, compliments, saying, hey, I enjoyed, you know, hearing about whatever the topic was. And that's neat to hear.
Sure. Well, and your involvement with Prairie Public goes beyond the Natural North Dakota essay. Listeners might be interested to know that you also serve on our radio council. What is the radio council and why did you want to be on it?
Radio council is kind of an advisory council to the director of radio that kind of provides input from the public. So it provides a sort of a focus group. To get that information from the public to the managers to help with, various kinds of decisions and management and what people are enjoying and maybe some things that they would like to change. So it helps give a public input to public radio.
So you listen. You're an avid listener then, and then you give critiques. And beyond that, though, you also have kind of this circle of friends that you ask for input?
I'll check with them in the course of – we meet quarterly.
Okay.
And so I'll check with friends and acquaintances. And I finally came into the new century and got a cell phone about a year ago. So now if I'm just visiting with someone and public radio comes up in a conversation, I'll make a little note on my cell phone to, you know, get back to the meetings when we have them. And so that's been kind of helpful as well, that modern technology.
Yeah, there's some cool apps out there for identifying constellations, which you might already have natural inclination towards.
But so that helps, in getting those kind of comments from the public.
Okay. When you're not teaching, when you're not writing, when you're not being on the radio council at Prairie Public, you're often biking or cross-country skiing.
Love it.
Yeah?
There's not much I'd rather do than cross-country ski. Mm. So I love winter. But no, we've got some good cross-country ski trails up in the Turtle Mountains, so I can get lots of skiing in. And then when the snow goes in the spring, I can get the bicycle out, and I have a road bike. So I try to get a few miles on that each day and maybe a tour or two in the summertime. You get out on the road, and you get to see things from a different perspective, get some exercise, and see some nature.
Yeah, and maybe get some ideas for your next Natural North Dakota essay.
Always, always.
Chuck Lura, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chuck writes the weekly essay that we air right here on Main Street called Natural North Dakota. He also teaches biology at Dakota College at Botano and writes a naturalist at large column that is printed in a few weekly newspapers, including the Lake Metegoshi Mirror.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Jamestown's Bruce Berg taught English for many years before retiring. Now he writes and voices commentaries for us. And today his essay is titled Uriah, as Bruce offers some literary analysis about the lessons drawn from one of the characters in the Charles Dickens novel, David Copperfield.
Do you remember the loathsome character from Charles Dickens' David Copperfield, named Uriah Heep? Dickens wrote about a man who had mastered phony humility, the art of the obsequious, and became the model of the sycophant, at least in Western literature. We could laugh at Heap as he practiced his fake humility on the social culture in the Dickens classic. I've been thinking of Uriah this past year, and I've concluded that the times of the monarch must have produced many who were forced by circumstances to be the forerunners of Uriah, not as comic characters, but serfs who learned to mind the ways of survival in lands that bred kings and queens. And if the royalty wanted 90% of the serf's crop, he learned it was best to watch all the king's horses and all the king's men ride off with most of his work. And he learned it was best to nod pleasantly with hat in hand. Of course, there were barons and dukes who also wanted their cut, and again, 'twas best to accept the theft with quiet acceptance. Our founding fathers had seen enough. They banded together at severe risk to their own lives to free the farmer, the laborer, mothers and fathers and children from lives of fawning servitude, with a Declaration of Independence that declared the equality of human rights and a sharp rebuke to the royalty that was woefully short of angels. The grievances against the king made up of 2/3 of the Declaration of Independence. Democracy had been done before, but it was a hard concept for the many who had fallen victim to the idea that letting George do it was easier than maintaining a government of the people and by the people. As Churchill once remarked, democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. This year I've sensed a return to a modern serf mentality in our nation. When the king demands loyalty, give it. And if Uriah Heep becomes a model for those who should be heaping scorn instead of accolades, well, so be it. Everything will work out somehow. And won't it be wonderful when the monarchy gets its proper due? Our founding fathers believed in respect for leadership, not obsequiousness. They believed in the equality of man, not a hierarchy of privilege. And as someone said about democracy, well, maintain it, if you can. This is Bruce Berg, Jamestown.
Thanks for that commentary from Jamestown, Bruce. The Coded 8 book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Direct Travel Satrum Tours, offering a Baltic cruise and Orion cruise in June 2018. Also offering 2 comprehensive Alaska land and sea tours in July and August 2018. More information at 1-800-833-8787 or satrumtravel.com.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with the Executive Director of the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County in Moorhead, that's Maureen Kelly Jonason, and we'll have a music performance from Eric Koskinen. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 2nd. If you've traveled around the Midwest, you may have seen signs for Butler Machinery. While you may have known it specializes in heavy equipment, you may not have known that this expanding company has its roots right here in North Dakota.
In 1915, Francis J. Butler, a former contractor from Grand Forks, became a Caterpillar equipment dealer. He began with very small facilities in Fargo and Grand Forks, providing service in eastern North Dakota and in Clay County, Minnesota. In 1957, Butler Machinery erected a larger facility on Main Avenue in Fargo, which was replaced in 1986 by the current facility on Interstate 29. Butler knew that farmers everywhere needed equipment, so in 1964 he expanded to western North Dakota, buying Schultz Machinery stores in Minot and Bismarck. A new Bismarck building was completed in 1976 and the current Minot building in 1978. In 1969, Francis passed the torch to his son, Matt Butler. Matt shared his father's vision of expansion and decided to go outside the state. In December of 1988, Butler Machinery acquired the assets of Kearns Machinery Company in South Dakota. This move gave them stores in Sioux Falls, Rapid City, and Aberdeen, greatly increasing the company size. In 1998, Matt passed the position of CEO to his son, Dan. Dan broadened the company focus beyond heavy equipment when he opened a training facility in Fargo in January of 2000. This space provides operators training for the increasingly complex heavy machinery. In 2012, Butler Machinery took another growing step when it purchased AGCO's Challenger and application lines in Nebraska. They opened a parts division in Kearney and built a store in Fremont. Their most recent expansion occurred on this date in 2015 when they acquired Henkins Equipment in Chadron, Nebraska, making this the third full-service location in the state. Butler remains privately held, with several hundred employees, a strong company that began humbly in North Dakota over 60 years ago. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
In most advanced economies, manufacturing is on the decline. Not so in Germany, where they get young people interested early.
Have the kids running around with open eyes, being interested in technical issues, see how things get done, and really get them motivated to want to do that.
Why Germany excels at manufacturing, on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, could geoengineering mitigate the effects of climate change? It's an approach inspired by volcanic eruptions that cool the Earth by injecting sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. We'll talk about it on Wednesday with Douglas McMartin, a senior research scientist at Cornell University. And we'll share a Trahat Reports commentary from UND journalism professor Mark Trahat. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.